traveling the world searching for equestrians of all breeds. The journey starts now on the International Equine Network.
You know, it's been a childhood dream. I mean, I used to go to Aqueduct in Belmont when I was 13, 14-year-old kid. My parents don't know, but sometimes cutting out of school and, you know, with $20 in my pocket and bet $2 a race, and, you know, I was addicted ever since. You know, I always said when I get old, I want to own a racehorse, and 10 years ago, I owned my first racehorse. And to me, it's watching these beautiful animals run down the stretch at 45 miles an hour, and, you know, the whole game, the handicapping, the, you know, the Saratoga racetrack, the people, the jockeys, the silks, the competitive nature, you know, winning, losing. It's just so exciting. It's become a family event where from my 88-year-old grandmother to my 9-year-old niece, we have 40, 50 people at the races, and, you know, it's like an added day to the holiday. You know, you have Thanksgiving, you have Christmas, you have Easter, and then you have one of the grade ones or big races, and, you know, and I get to name them after some of my family members, and it's just a lot of fun when you treat everyone, friends and family.
They're coming down to the finish. Stop Charging Maria has won the Alabama.
The goal was to hopefully advertise that she's a big spender and maybe embarrass her to the point where she might think about spending. It's actually done the opposite to where now she thinks she's got a reputation uphold and she's got Stop Spending Maria, Stop Shopping Maria, Stop Charging Maria, Unlimited Budget. It's kind of backfired. Now she also watches the purse. And if the horse wins, she figures out what the horse wins and thinks that's her money he spent.
Every time a foal's born, you're thinking about what it might be and what it might become.
The backside of the horses, that's why we're all here. That, you know, if not for the horsemen and the horses, there wouldn't be a derby.
Being able to see the grandstand from the racetrack point of view, it's really outrageous.
Here they come, and it's anybody's race.
And Squabs from California is the 1955 Kentucky Derby champion. And it's Secretariat that wins it by 2.5 lengths.
It's a different race, and it has to be on your resume.
Now gets to go to the winner's circle. It's Churchill Downs on Derby Day.
For a lot of Americans, that is racing. The Kentucky Derby is racing.
On the first Saturday in May, more than 170,000 people will fill these seats at Churchill Downs, where they're going to witness history in the making. Not just any history, it's the 150th running of the Kentucky Derby. And what a race it's going to be to see in person this year. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for this WHAS 11 News special presentation. I'm Doug Proffitt. After the race, the winner of the 150th Derby will come right here to the historic winner's circle to get the garland of roses, where 149 other Kentucky Derby winners have been since 1875. They are continuing the legacy of the fastest 2 minutes in sports. It was May 17th, 1875, when Aristides won the first Kentucky Derby in front of a crowd of 10,000 people. But it was another 20 years before the iconic spires of Churchill Downs first welcomed racing fans. Over the next century, traditions were created.
And Swaps is only the second California bred colt to earn the Garland of Roses here at Churchill Downs in Louisville.
Champions were crowned.
It's Secretariat drawing up, Turcotte just sitting on him, and it's Secretariat that wins it by 2.5 lengths.
And history was made. At the center of it all, of course, is the historic track, which first opened in this spot in South Louisville when the gates opened in 1875. It's a special place to so many people behind the scenes. And our Shane McAllister is talking to one man who, for this place, it's more than just a job. It's a piece of him.
McDonald's has got the golden arches and Nike's got the swoosh. We've got the twin spires.
Walking across one of the many balconies at Churchill Downs, Greg Bush is face to face with a flood of memories.
I look out across there, you know, and I see where I got married. You know, that's really cool.
Exchanging vows in 1993 in the winner's circle. An easy choice, he said.
Where else would I get married? With all the connections I had here, you know, the love of this place. She did shoot me down when I said we should come up on horseback. She wasn't going for that one, though.
The tradition of the track ties back to almost every part of his life.
We've got two puppies, Rosie and Oakley, for roses and oaks.
Even the birth of his daughter, another negotiation with his bride.
If you have this baby on Derby weekend, it's like we're going to name her Derby, and the middle name will be whoever the winning jockey is. It's like, and it was a chuckle, laugh, laugh. And she said, well, how about Darby? And we like that.
I do's, dogs, and a daughter all traced back here. His home away from home as early as high school.
When I was in high school, I thought that I wanted to be a jockey. And so I did work in the stable area with the horses, but that was short-lived. Genetics got me. And it just, I decided that was not something I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
Instead, he built a career on the other side of the turf, earning a degree he could use behind a wagering window.
When I graduated from college, I had offers from other businesses to go to work for them. And it's like, no, I enjoy being around the races.
He found himself full-time at Churchill Downs in 1991, when the track was a totally different place.
I'm going to describe it as a large battleship. It was just a big white building. It had all the emergency staircases on the outside of it. And again, it was an older looking building.
Since then, the racetrack has reinvented itself time and time again, something that has come with challenges at times. He remembers Derby 130 in 2004.
This building did not exist. We ran the Derby. It was a demolition Derby. There was no clubhouse building here. So all of these seats that were going to long-term be built, and the seats that had been here before we tore it down, got moved to the infield. We built a 4-acre tent in the infield, which you could tell it was a tent if you looked up. It had hard walls, all the amenities that you had in this building, but it was out in the infield. That was the year that we had a torrential downpour as the race ran. I remember watching video that day, and there were people swimming in the infield.
Another race day that stands out, 2007, when months of preparation led up to a visit from the Queen of England.
So from the time we were notified that she was coming, we had, I believe it was like 32 meetings with our Secret Service, the United States Secret Service, and their counterparts over in England, doing the planning on when is she coming? How is she getting here? What's her path from the time she enters the property, pulls up to a gate? I remember the first meeting, we're standing out in the parking lot where she was going to come in, and they asked where that manhole cover went to. They were afraid, you know, that some ninja was going to come out and do something dastardly.
Churchill staff, known for a focus on hospitality, went above and beyond to make Derby Day one the Queen would never forget.
Our chef at the time with Levy's, he actually created a special blend of tea because she enjoyed her afternoon tea every day, so she could have her own Derby tea while she was here.
He calls that year a high. Of course, there have been lows. 2020 was difficult. The Derby was rescheduled for a Saturday in September, something Greg says they would do differently if they could go back now.
When we were making the plans, we felt as though we might come out of COVID earlier than we did, and we'd be able to have a stands full of people. So that's why we moved it to September. Obviously, we didn't get to do that. We ended up with just the horsemen that were racing with us that day. We're the only ones that were allowed to come out. So we probably would have run it in the spring, hindsight. But that was a crystal ball we didn't have.
No crystal ball, but he can give you a peek into the past. Greg's co-workers consider his office a treasure trove of sorts, from the wacky wobblers.
All the bobbleheads up here.
To the more unusual artifacts.
Triple crown winning American Pharaoh poop.
He knows how to appreciate the best of horse racing history, a loyalty to the tradition and to the people who came before him, including one in particular.
He's looking down and smiling.
His dad had a 71-year career at Churchill Downs. Everything Greg does today, he says he does with his dad in mind.
He used to tell me how proud I made him. That, you know, when he would see me rising and getting to where I had and accomplishments, that he was very proud.
That pride resonates in the Churchill Downs leader, who looks forward to every Derby day. That's when he gets to see his passion for the races reflected on more than 100,000 faces.
It's the greatest place on earth.
Having a horse make it to the Kentucky Derby and then win is no easy job. Perhaps nobody knows that better than the trainers. Dwayne Lucas has been at it for decades. He's won 4 Kentucky Derbies. And as our sports director Ken Spencer found out, he has no plans to hang up his saddle just yet.
It's another day of training under the twin spires at Churchill Downs for Dwayne Lucas.
I thrive on that. I thrive on that competition of the big arena, the tough race.
As it always does, the alarm on this morning went off at 3:30. The 88-year-old Hall of Fame trainer is still going strong.
I just stay away from the sofa. Everybody I know that gets on that sofa, they start aging.
If you don't believe him, just ask his wife, Lori. She often joins him in his office. If these walls could talk, concrete covered by history and inspiration.
I can't keep up with him. We're 17 years apart and I can't keep up with him.
After switching over from quarter horses to thoroughbreds in 1968, the goal was simple.
As soon as I started switching over, I realized that the Derby was the one that you wanted on your resume.
Lucas attended his first Kentucky Derby in 1980. Genuine Risk captured the Garland of Roses that day. He still remembers his feelings from the stands.
You feel like you're in the big leagues, and you better step it up.
He was hooked. He entered his first horse in the Derby the very next year, Partez, who finished 3rd to Pleasant Colony. In 1988, an elusive Derby victory was finally his.
Lucas and Stevens, it's a driving finish, winning colors by a head.
When you win that first one, you get all puffed up. You come back to the barn and you say, gosh, I just won the Kentucky Derby, and what a great thing. And you really think it's you, and you soak it up.
Lucas wins it.
Lucas would capture 3 more Derby wins, Thunder Gulch in 1995, Grindstone in 1996, and Charismatic in 1999.
Charismatic trained by Lucas on the outside.
It's the victory with Grindstone that is the most special, because he was able to get W.T. Young and Overbrook Farm to the winner's circle on the first Saturday in May.
We embraced and exchanged some words, and I think that moment was very special to him, obviously, and very special to me.
Through the years, Lucas has seen several of his assistant trainers go out on their own and accomplish great things in the sport.
It allowed you the opportunity to work with some really good horses. It allowed you some responsibility, you know, on your own while still under sort of a coaching umbrella.
I didn't hire anybody that I didn't think would go out on his own eventually. If they didn't have that drive and passion that I thought someday they'd walk in and say, boss, I'm going to try it on my own, I didn't want him.
With all of his accomplishments, the outside of his barn looks more like a record book. Recently, the Kentucky Derby Museum honored Lucas with their first ever Lifetime Achievement Award. In total, Lucas has saddled 49 Derby contenders. He's always looking for the next one.
Next year, we have absolutely got the best yearling crop last year that we bought that are now 2-year-olds. They're the best we've had.
Absolutely no sign of slowing down.
I'm only going to be 89, so, I mean, what the hell? I told my wife I'll only do this till I'm 95, and then I'll probably back off.
We'll believe it when we see it.
The journey to the winner's circle right here actually begins 3 years before the horses ever enter a starting gate on farms across the United States. In the heart of horse country here in Kentucky sits the famed Spendthrift Farm, where for decades they've bred and raised Derby contenders. Brooke Hash takes us to Lexington.
The Kentucky Derby, it's really the central race in American racing. If you meet somebody from outside the industry, there's one question that you're going to get. Have you won the Kentucky Derby?
Ned Toffee says there are 2 special moments for a horse owner on Derby Day. The walk from the backstretch.
Looking at this wall of people, 170,000 strong, is really special, really breathtaking.
And then there's the winner's circle.
We were fortunate enough in 2020 to win the Kentucky Derby with Authentic.
The year when COVID kept fans at home.
It just was a very strange day. It felt nothing like a typical Kentucky Derby until the gates opened. and then you really became focused on that field of horses and rooting Authentic home.
Authentic has won the Kentucky Derby!
It's a long road to get to this track, and for thoroughbreds like Authentic, their journey starts here.
I'm Ned Toffey. I'm the general manager at Spendthrift Farm.
Nestled on 1,200 acres in the heart of horse country.
In 2003, Wayne Hughes asked me to come run his farm. He didn't even have a farm at the time. He just said, I'm going to buy a farm and I'd love you to come run it for me. When I found out that he had bought Spendthrift Farm, it was a little bit like somebody in baseball saying, well, I bought Fenway Park. Would you come run it for me?
There's no shortage of stories on this farm.
I got a tour here when I was about 4 years old in 1968.
And then there's the royal visit from Queen Elizabeth back in the 80s.
Seattle Slough was the still to this day the only undefeated Triple Crown winner. And he was one of the horses that she came here to see. So that's really a great moment in Spendthrift history.
Years later, the farm fell into disrepair. But new ownership in the early 2000s helped restore it to its former glory.
I think my favorite spot on the farm is the old original wooden stud barn. We restored it. When I look at it, I feel like we got everything right. And it really, I think it encompasses everything that Spendthrift's about.
Breeding champions is a full-time job.
It's round the clock.
Trying to create the perfect match for the next generation of great athletes, factoring in their speed, endurance, pedigree, and temperament.
We have 27 stallions. We have the largest stallion roster in North America, and we bred over 3,400 mares last year.
Most days, these farm roads are filled with trailers transporting one mare after another into the breeding barn.
Breeding on a thoroughbred farm is a very highly choreographed, where there's about five people in the breeding shed with the mare and the stallion, making sure that everything goes as safely and efficiently as it possibly can.
I didn't realize how big of an operation this is.
Yeah, most people don't.
The majority of mares are brought in for the process, so fewer than 100 call Spendthrift home, which means any given year, the farm welcomes about 70 babies.
Newborn foals are, I would say on average, are about 125 pounds at birth. So it's a big baby.
The farm holds a lot of promise, and those sired vie into Mischief, its leading stallion.
He's a horse that we raced and then retired to stud here. He started at a fairly modest stud fee of about $12,500. He now stands for $250,000. He is 5 years in a row now the leading general sire in North America. And the last time that was done was in the 1960s by a horse named Bold Ruler, who sired Secretariat. And prior to that, the last time it was done was 1870 by a horse named Lexington.
At 19 years old, Into Mischief also happens to be the sire of Authentic, who's since retired from racing and joined his dad back in the stables.
Their stalls are right across from each other, and Into Mischief can look across the aisleway and be a proud papa.
This year, there'll be no fewer than half a dozen horses with this family's pedigree running in the Oaks and Derby.
And we'll be rooting them on.
And then it's back to business.
We're always looking for the next horse. We're always looking for the next big sire, the next big broodmare. That is really what sort of drives us every day.
According to the Jockey Club, 17,200 thoroughbred foals were registered in the United States last year, but only 20 of them can make it to the starting gate on the first Saturday in May.
I always say I think part of my success as a female was the fact that I didn't really, you know, it wasn't overcoming the obstacles, it was that I just didn't really see them.
In an industry once dominated by men, women are making names for themselves in horse racing. The progress that's been made and the work still to be done. On this track, there's one division, one field of competitors, and one chance to win. Horse racing is one of the few of the major sports where men and women go head-to-head. In the storied history of the Kentucky Derby, six women have made it to the field of 20. Helmets on, heads down, the jockeys raced ahead, creating a space where one didn't exist for decades. Here's Grace McKenna.
Each May, 23-year-old thoroughbreds race for glory. Whether or not they gallop into history, when the race is over, the garland given, they have lives left to lead. That is where Rosie Napravnik comes in.
And the horses are not really retired then, in a way, you know?
They're just retired from racing, yeah. There's so much life. Like, they live into their, you know, late 20s, 30s, so there's a lot of life left.
Napravnik's off-track sports horses trains retired racehorses for new jobs, like dressage, show jumping, barrel racing.
What inspires me so much is, like, when they come off the track and they know nothing but track life, and then they're just so open to whatever it is you throw at them.
Off-track is essentially a second act for retired racehorses. It's actually a second act for Napravnik herself.
Oh, hi, Mama.
Before retiring in 2014, she spent years on the front side of horses' careers, in turn, winning a place in history.
Rosie Napravnik is the only woman to have won the Kentucky Oaks, and she did it twice. There's only been six women who have ridden in the Kentucky Derby in the entire 150 years of the Kentucky Derby.
Kentucky Derby Museum curator Jessica Whitehead says women weren't in the spotlight in the early days of the Derby. In fact, it wasn't even legal for them to become jockeys until 1968, when Kathy Kuzner successfully sued for the right to a license.
Kathy Kuzner said, listen, I can ride horses as well as any of these male jockeys.
At breakneck speed, Diane Crump raced for the record books 2 years later, the first woman to ride in the most exciting 2 minutes in sports.
That was an incredible moment because of the visibility of the Kentucky Derby.
In the decades after, women built their careers racing at the highest levels, including 8 more Kentucky Derbies.
It's a special race, but it takes a lot to get there.
Napravnik's shot came when she was 23. It had been a dream for years, spurred by childhood pony racing and a movie about Triple Crown winners.
I always wanted to be a jockey, and I didn't see the difference between men and women when I was 7.
No one would have known there was a woman in the field when she rode her very first race under trainer Dickie Small.
I rode under AR so that nobody would know that I was a girl when I was first coming about.
Napravnik won that race, and then won again and again, taking her all the way to the 2011, 2013, and 2014 Derbies.
Being able to see the grandstand from the racetrack point of view, like, there's only so many people that even get to see that view, and it's really outrageous. It's very cool.
In 2012, Napravnik became the first woman to win the Kentucky Oaks, streaking past jockey John Velasquez, riding Believe You Can.
Turning for home, like, nose and nose with Johnny on the favorite, and knowing that I was going to beat him was, like, one of the best moments of my life.
Napravnik feels she got a fair shot and earned her place as a rider, gender notwithstanding. Some of her early predecessors, though, faced vocal opposition.
There were Derby-winning jockeys who were saying in national publications, your spaghetti's burning, get back in the kitchen, to these women.
But with the right to ride secured, those early female jockeys charted a path for future generations.
Still, there's been no woman to win the Kentucky Derby, and a lot of that has to do with opportunities.
These days, women claim roles across the horse racing industry, though expert Kaitin Bradar says that wasn't always the case.
I look back to somebody like Julie Crone and I say, you know, she was the only one. And she inspired so many to give it a try.
Bradar is hopeful for the future of the sport in the hands of its promising young jockeys.
In New York, you have jockeys like Katie Davis and you have Maddie Oliver. So now it's more commonplace to have women in the jocks room, and the exceptions are the places that don't have any women riders.
After all, it's been 150 years since the first Kentucky Derby, much fewer since the first female jockeys took the reins.
It changed so quickly, in my estimation, even though I know a lot of people would think it changed very slowly.
In the grand scheme of things, it's only a matter of time in a sport where each second counts.
I won 5 races on Cantonic.
Napravnik knows the feeling of those seconds well.
We have Old Ironsides, who I rode in 2006 and 8, or 6 till 2008.
She credits her success to strategy, determination, and a refusal to see obstacles.
Keeping your head down and doing your job and always trying to improve is, I think, you know, what the journey's all about.
A journey shared by the women behind her and the women ahead, who will one day ride to victory on the first Saturday in May.
A witness to the history over the decades, Churchill Downs and the Twin Spires.
That over the 130 years, they have taken on an iconic role recognizable around the world.
But they weren't always there for the Derbies, the history behind the iconic structures, and what may have inspired them. You are looking at the true landmark, even the company trademark logo of Churchill Downs, the freshly painted Twin Spires. recognized around the world. They say the Kentucky Derby and Louisville to those who see them. They are well cared for here. But there's one thing about the 150th Kentucky Derby. Those twin spires, well, they are not 150 years old. In fact, they came 20 years later after the first Derby. I happen to notice over the decades around Louisville, many other buildings in our city built by the designer of the spires. So we wanted to know, what inspired the spires? We caught up with historian Tom Owen.
They've stood right here through America at war, tornadoes, snowstorms, but they weren't made for tragedy.
They now take on eternal springtime. They suggest beauty and tradition and the blossoming of beginnings and new beginnings.
The twin spires at Churchill Downs tower over triumph.
And they're off.
The first Kentucky Derby was 1875, but didn't have twin spires. In fact, it didn't even have the grandstand where the grandstand was built in 1895.
We asked Louisville's most famous historian, 84-year-old Tom Owen, to unlock the mystery of who thought of those spires.
There were new owners of Churchill Downs, and there was a new day coming. The spires were kind of an architectural afterthought. I'm suggesting to you they were not a big deal in 1895.
Plus, he takes us on a tour of Louisville. D.X. Murphy, the firm that built the grandstand and the spires in 1895, was actively building other remarkable structures across the city at the same time.
They surely must have been the busiest architectural firm in town.
Like this public library at 17th and Jefferson.
So the spires were only 18 years old. They were brand new nearly when they came down to this area and built this library.
Well, I'm telling you, this firm, they did unbelievable number of projects. Yes, the library, 1913.
And St. Patrick's School at 15th and Market. So if the spires were an afterthought, how do they become so world famous?
I believe this building could very, very likely be the inspiration of Joseph Valdez's twin spires at Churchill Downs.
The Louisville Trust Building in downtown Louisville at 5th and Market. The spark for the spires, and who was Joseph Dominic Valdez?
He's a Louisville kid. He lives with his family at 23 or 24 years of age at 20th and Grand in the California neighborhood.
Valdez went to St. X and was hired on not as an architect, but as a draftsman by D.X. Murphy.
We also believe that Valdez learned just basic construction skills from his dad, who was the carpenter.
Back to this building. The D.X. Murphy office was located right across the street from it during its construction. It was finished 2 years before the spires were built.
Literally under his nose, because all during construction and immediately after completion, Joseph Valdez saw the Louisville Trust Building.
Here are the original architect drawings of the spires, preserved today by the architecture firm Luckin and Farley. D.X. Murphy is listed, but Valdez is not mentioned anywhere on the plans. Take a look at the spires. Tall but thin windows, under the curved archways.
There is the inspiration of the spires with the octagonal windows around it. And then look at all of the rounded arches, both on the top of the tower and the second level of the tower. And you see the same rounded arches embodied in both the grandstand and in the twin spire. But I'm telling you, the graceful inspiration for Joseph Valdez, likely, according to me at least, and some others, was the Louisville Trust Building.
Some other examples by D.X. Murphy before the spires: Presentation Academy, the turret on top of the Fraser History Museum.
So when Joseph Valdez said, this grandstand needs something, where do you think he started?
There had to be a reason for them, more than just an afterthought. Owen believes it was this.
He suggested that they were pleasantly attractive, but that they were not architecturally significant.
Ironically, Valdez would never, ever visit Churchill on its biggest day.
He loved to go to the races, but never, never went on Derby Day, because he was always kind of fretful that the heavy loads of all of those fans in the grandstand might cause a railing to fall off and somebody get hurt. And so he was fretful about that.
But he designed it.
He designed it. But yes, he designed it. But he was 24 years old.
So as we celebrate 150 years of the Derby, we actually honor 130 years of the Twin Spires. And it would be none other than Matt Wynn, the president of Churchill Downs, who made the Derby world famous, who summed up the Spires the best to their creator.
Matt Wynn later said to Joe, "Joe, when you die, those Twin Spires will endure and will never be removed as a tribute to you."
And there you have it, one more perfect description of them, enduring. So why were the Spires built 20 years after the first Kentucky Derby? Well, this grandstand is not the original grandstand. The first one, built in 1875 when the track opened, was on the backside. It was facing west into the hot afternoon sun every day. The race fans were so uncomfortable, the owners of Churchill Downs decided to tear that one down, and they rebuilt the new one right here in this very spot. While the Spires have remained unchanged over the years, the same can't be said for the track surrounding them. When the first grandstand was constructed in 1875, the track's paddock was just a simple building standing beside it. Over the next 100 years, other versions of the paddock would be built, including a new tunnel that would take horses from the saddling area right to the track. Then in 1986, a new paddock, complete with state-of-the-art tote board, was built. It would remain until Churchill Downs announced a $200 million redesign of the space, opening just in time for Derby 150.
This is the most transformational project that we've done here at Churchill Downs. It brings back into the focus the horses. Right when you walk through the paddock gate, you're going to see horses saddled beneath the Twin Spires. I think the Twin Spires are back in focus, and that's very important to us. It's our version of the Nike swoosh or the McDonald's M or any logo that's familiar. The Twin Spires say Churchill Downs.
Still to come, and the history of the Kentucky Derby runs deep. But for decades, the faces and the names of the early jockeys who dominated the first Kentucky Derbies were ignored. African-American jockeys were the early winners in the race, going back to the very first Derby. Now historians are working to ensure their contributions aren't forgotten. Here's Eric King.
This historic track has seen its fair share of thrilling and memorable moments. And every year on the first Saturday in May, there's a collective hope that this too will go down among the very best. We share that history and those traditions together. We want to make an effort to ensure that we're sharing all of that history. Some of it might surprise you.
For decades, African-American jockeys played a pivotal role in shaping the sport of horse racing, particularly here at the Kentucky Derby. In fact, 13 of the first 15 Kentucky Derby winners were guided to victory by African-American riders. Names like Oliver Lewis, Alonzo Clayton, and Isaac Murphy became legendary for their skill, agility, and unparalleled connection with their horses.
Early years, African-Americans are the ones really making the impact on the race. 13 to 15 jockeys in that very first race in 1875. We look at the first 28 runnings of the Kentucky Derby up until 1902. Over half of those are won by African-American jockeys.
Chris Goodlett is a curator at the Kentucky Derby Museum.
Highlights the contributions of African-Americans to thoroughbred racing. So we go back to the era before the Kentucky Derby, going back to the 1820s. It's a very Kentucky-focused exhibit. At that time, racing was pretty much run by the enslaved. Southern economy is a plantation economy, and the enslaved are taking care of the horses, which includes riding the horses.
Segregation and Jim Crow laws were responsible for dwindling the numbers of African Americans in the horse racing industry as a whole. Several reports show white jockeys began violently attacking their African American counterparts by boxing them out during races, running them into rails, and hitting them with riding crops. These attacks prevented black jockeys from finishing in the money, which led horse owners and trainers to stop employing African-American jockeys. For some owners and trainers, it could have been a matter of prejudice. For others, it was perhaps a business decision. But the history of their successes lives on, even through people still working at Churchill Downs today. Last year, we introduced you to Bill Vest, who's the backside security manager at the track. He is now in his 49th year. He told us one of his greatest privileges is having learned from the best.
Well, I came here in 1975, the Saturday morning after Foolish Pleasure had won the Derby the week Saturday prior. And I was young, and I was in awe of this place. And I thought, wow, I've made it to the big time. This is Churchill Downs, the Derby. Yeah, and I was a groom then, you know, learning my trade back then. And I was fortunate enough to be here when the old guard, I like to call them, the old African-American grooms, you're talking about the best horsemen in the world, they were here. I got to walk with them.
The dedication and expertise of African-Americans are woven into the fabric of the Kentucky Derby, reminding us that it's more than just a race. It's a diverse celebration of tradition and resilience. It's that history the Kentucky Derby Museum wants to honor and celebrate.
Black jockeys in the Kentucky Derby disappeared in 1921. It would be another 79 years before another African-American jockey would take the reins. That was in the year 2000. Still to come here on The Greatest 2 Minutes, they're as big as the history of this big derby. The Rose Garland and the Mint Julep.
There are only a few places in American culture where you can wear a derby hat.
An evolution of derby hats and fashion over the last 100 years. For decades, the real stars of the Derby haven't been found in the paddock or on the red carpet. Instead, they're the style icons who manage to craft the most stunning, extravagant, or outlandish race day looks. With 150 years of practice under their belts, Derby goers show their passion for fashion with a long line of trendsetters going back to the earliest days of the race. Here's Grace McKenna.
It's bright, it's bold, it's a sure bet. Fashion on the first Saturday in May is as ever-changing as the field of competitors and the Kentucky weather. But even 150 years ago, before the pastels and the patterns, the aim was the same.
Horse racing was a social sport. You were coming to see and be seen at this place that was pretty much the apex of society.
The clothes from those early years tell the stories of their time, stories now preserved by Kentucky Derby Museum curator Jessica Whitehead.
There was a really significant transition in the way when men and women were dressing in American culture in the transition from the 1900s, 1910s into the 1920s and 1930s, and that was the innovation of sportswear.
Though modern fabrics and colors widened the spectrum of possibility, decades of derby goers past still found ways to stand out.
They call it shrimp pink.
In 2024, though, even more iconic than an electric ensemble is what tops it off.
This whole idea of the derby hat, that was a major change in derby fashion history that came around, you know, right at this big transitional time in American culture.
Whitehead says during the 50s and 60s, as hats became less common in daily life, they found a new purpose as a derby staple. And from the very beginning, people took risks with whimsy.
There's always been a tension between really traditional fashion and really traditional ensembles and sort of outlandish. I just love how clever it is to make make Viking horns into the twin spires. It's just inspired.
A wide-brimmed hat was long the standard look. The Whitehead says in more recent years, a European transplant, the Fascinator, wedged its way to the front of the pack. From the infield to the suites, derby headwear can feel like a clash of cultures. Handcrafted masterpieces keep a firm grip on some.
I made the hat in 1981, and it's people just really enjoy it.
While others turn to master milliners as the arbiters of taste.
And it looks chaotic, but I actually know where everything is.
Alana Kogan, a.k.a. the Hat Doctor, started making hats while in Kentucky for med school to pay off student debt.
I thought that I was a fashion expert coming from New York, and I've seen it all. But then when I saw the fashion at the Kentucky Derby, I was just mesmerized.
Necessity, ever the mother of invention, became a passion.
Now, the full-time radiologist is also one of the Kentucky Derby Museum's featured milliners and chief trendsetters.
People really want to show what they have this year. They want to show their personal style. They want to put their best foot forward and have a gorgeous outfit head to toe.
For Derby 150, she says reds and greens are having a moment, as well as shapes that nod to the past and call back tradition.
Especially for Derby 150, I think people kind of want to have that classic look of a wide-brim hat.
Tradition is Whitehead's bread and butter. This summer, she has the tall task of documenting the decades in a new exhibit, a collection of past Derby ensembles sourced from people's own closets and wardrobes.
We're so excited to be celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Kentucky Derby.
The goal is to tell the story of fashion from 1875 to 2024 and every year in between.
This is a great example of the way that fashion had to sort of adapt to the times and how Derby fashion can help us tell the story of the Kentucky Derby.
After all, if the clothes make the man, then fashion history is really about our shared story.
You're sending a message about your individuality, about your selfhood, about where we are at this particular time in history.
And that is a story worth remembering.
Wearing their hats and colorful suits, you'll often see race fans with a mint julep in their hands. Well, that's a tradition that's a century old. It dates back to 1939, when the mint julep became the official drink of the Kentucky Derby. That's the same year Churchill Downs created the official souvenir glass after noticing people took home glasses the year before. But the history of the mint julep in Kentucky goes back much further, back to the 19th century. The iconic silver cups were often given away as prizes for horse races in the early 1800s. And historians say they have every reason to believe it was at that very first Derby in 1875. On the first Saturday in May, the crowds filling Churchill Downs will pause and join together to sing My Old Kentucky Home. The horses will walk from the paddock out on the historic track past the cheering crowd right to the starting gate. The University of Louisville Marching Band will be performing the song they've done for almost every year since 1936. It's just one tradition during an event that is so rich with traditions and history. From the garland of roses to the pageantry of the fashion to the love of the horses themselves, the Kentucky Derby is unlike any other race. It has survived through world wars, a Great Depression, the Great Flood of 1937, tornadoes, and of course, two global pandemics, 1918 and 2020. And now, just before 7 p.m. on the first Saturday in May, we will do it all over again. But this year, the Grand Race enters rare territory for any sporting event in the world. That's because we will be wondering, on the edge of our seats, who will take home the garland of roses in the 150th running of the Kentucky Derby. It truly is the greatest 2 minutes.
Usually get up between 3:30 and 3:45 and head this way. It's early and daylight saving time is definitely no friend of horse trainers. We got to start training a little bit in the dark, and that's a little bit annoying. We go over the day before what each horse is going to do the following day, how far they're breezing, who they're breezing with. So we try to have it all laid out on a set list where it's going to pretty much flow like clockwork, hopefully. Our main check is before they go to the track. If there's something minor going on, you can catch it before they come out and overdo it. You know what we should do? Let's take the bell boots off them and gallop them.
Todd's a very hard worker. He wants to do the best he can with all the horses, and he knows every single one of them by the back of his hand. I think that's what makes him as good as he is. He 3-8 pole, 4-8 pole to the wire. to the eighth pole, quarter pole to the wire, Melvin. Wire to wire, Ivan.
He's got just under 100 horses here, watching him gallop, watching him jog, and of course, watching him breeze. Very, very much involved in knowing exactly what's going on with every horse.
Can't have your eye on each one at the same time, but you know, you kind of get to know where they are and how they're doing.
Hey, boss, how are you?
Doing well.
Race number 8, Comfort, John Velasquez.
I live in New Mexico, 1,000 miles away. Eddie lives in Houston, over 1,000 miles away, and it's comforting to know, and we sleep well knowing that Todd Pletcher is watching after our horses.
Now, I'm not a huge talker, so unless it's Michael Coley asking me 1,000 questions, then generally most of my conversations are, you know, we can wrap up fairly quickly. I don't want you to send them, but, okay. You know, let them go, okay. Help him out. He hadn't broken a while. Make sure he gets position.
It is Competitive Edge off the turn in front. He's got a 2-length lead coming to the 8th pole.
You know, I still get the butterflies in my stomach, but it's not a business where you can just sit back and say, oh, you know, the season's over, we won the championship. You know, we have a big day on Saturday, but then Sunday morning we'll have some important breezes and, you know, stuff getting ready for the next weekend. So it's just, it kind of doesn't allow you much time to reflect.
It's 7 days a week, so you have to love what you're doing and love the horses. And if you do, then it's the job for you.
The results are very concrete. You know, we're training horses, preparing them for races, and they're running. If they're running well, we're doing our job. If they're not, we got to figure out something else to do.
He rode on top of the bars of the car, inside the car, and the next thing he gets after, he says, that was the A1, Sharon.
Now she's there telling us not to stand under them. Comfy anyway.
He wears them skiing, Thady.
Yeah.
They wear them skiing. They love them.
Yeah.
Thady, is this the same camera as you wear skiing?
See you.
Yeah, it's a better one.
It's a better one. Yeah, yeah. Dad, could you get me a better one? Yeah. you ski too fast for that camera anyhow.
Well, he goes too fast, that's for sure.
I hope so.
not 2 miles today.
That's at the end.
Well, the whole idea is to get out there and warm up and enjoy yourselves. And after 2 miles around there, one thing is,
well,
you'll be warmed up.
Yeah.
He likes the track and the ground, that I will give you. Okay. He's big enough.
Halfway there. All right.
The Ineos 10 token for David Lanigan, and then High Jeans in blue and yellow.
Okay, thank you. Huh? Yeah. You alright?
Yep.
Yeah. 2.
Yeah,
we've got a rope.
After letting the odds go, yeah.
Huh?
We're going to let the odds go.
Okay. Christoph, all right? Yeah. Enough.